By the way, I wanted to comment that this was Mickey L. Smitten. This is a system where, for example, this approximation is occurring as a long time scale. There are some people who are looking at these systems at really short time scales, not just milliseconds, but maybe microseconds or nanoseconds. Right. And so they really, assuming that this is a correct system, this is not giving you all you've suppressed all the fast kinetics by doing this approximation. Anyway, that's just a comment. So let's go on, because the second half is supposed to be on identifiability. And what I wanted to do, and in all these talks, you know, it's always vocabulary. Even when you learn biology, it's always vocabulary. So I wanted to give you my perspective on the vocabulary that I see. First of all, I have two items here. On the left side, I have models, and they have parameters. And on the right-hand side, I have data. And the real world iterates between the two. And the formalism, the advantage of mathematics and statistics is that we can use these tools to enhance knowledge. Obviously, we never finish. Our models are never correct, but they get closer to the truth. So one way, one approach is if I have a structural model and parameters in my hand, what do I do with it? Well, obvious thing is to solve it, to simulate. So this I call the forward problem, and it's not trivial. These models are extremely complex. To integrate them might be a terribly difficult task. There's numerical issues. But it is straightforward in the sense that once I know the model, the parameters, and I have it in silico, I have it in the computer, I can do some in silico experiments and make some predicted data. The key issue is this direction here, which is, notice I made it much larger. Because this is the inverse problem. Given data, what can I infer about structural model parameters? And in fact, the box things are the things that you're doing. This part here is model building. We're all doing that. Model building includes prior knowledge and data. And the data that you collect, you don't just simply want to get random data. Very often you want to work with experimentalists and talk about experiment design. And there's well-defined statistical issues in experiment design. How do I get, how can I design an experiment so I'm going to get the most that I can out of the system? And you define what you mean by most. Do I want to get precise parameter estimates? Do I want to optimally discriminate amongst candidate models? Do I just simply want to verify a model? So the inverse problem, in a simplistic fashion, I have these three bullets. Some of these cases may actually be mutually exclusive. Just because I can do parameter estimation assumes that I know the structural model, and I just want to fill in what's that rate constant. On the other hand, I might want to do model discrimination. I might have four different models I'm testing. Then the experiment design in that case might be different. It might be an experiment design which is really bad at getting parameters, but might be very good at discriminating amongst the models. So the best experiment depends upon what you want to do. And so even when you're going around the loop and you think you're finished, you're never finished, because you're always testing your model. You're setting up straw hypotheses or novel ideas. You're tweaking it. You're trying to extrapolate. You're trying to see, where is this model going? Where is it revealing methodology? There are two terms I don't like. Parameter optimization, I see all the time. I think I know what people mean by that. They're thinking of, well, I have a machine here on the left, and I want to tweak it so it looks like the real world. So I will optimize the parameters so that it matches the data. Well, okay, that's sort of maybe that S-system approach. But optimal with respect to what? Optimal with respect to understanding the system? Optimal with respect to just simply matching the data in some qualitative sense? Well, that's one approach, but it doesn't have the flavor that it's going to then return for you understanding about the parameters. There also is another concept of parameter optimization, which is interesting, and that's from a teleological point of view. If we think that biological systems have evolved to have some optimal properties, we may have a model in silico and we may say, well, what parameters would give the system more robustness to a buffeting from the outside? what parameters would make this system grow the best or minimize the chance that a P53 mutation occurs that screws up the cancer, the cell cycle, whatever it is. And those are experiments you can do in silico where you ask specific biological questions and then optimize the parameters with respect to the biological outcome. I think that's a legitimate use of optimization.
There's also the trade-off between, especially in a data mining context, where K is much bigger than N, the number of variables is much bigger than thousands. Is the idea, too frequently data miners fall into the trap of wanting to fit the model to the data so much that they get precision, that they get a model that you can't really understand. So they lose accuracy, they get precision, but lose accuracy. That's a constant problem.
Too many parameters,
too much accuracy, too many parameters, and too restricted to one set of data.
Well, actually, so I'm going to address that because you say it's too much precision. It's too much precision in matching the observed data, but it's terrible precision in the domain of understanding what the parameters are. Right. Oh, okay. Okay. So just to keep the vocabulary here for the general audience, I would say too much precision in predicting and having the predicted data match the observed data, and not enough precision in understanding what the parameters are. And I'll illustrate that in a moment diagrammatically.
So a useful term for those who haven't heard is overfitting. That if you basically
overfitting.
If you have a set of data, if you introduce enough parameters, you can usually fit that set of data very well. But the likelihood of, as you expand your data set and continuing to fit, gets worse as you make your model more complicated. With a simple model that fits well, it's much more likely to continue to fit as you get in more data, more information. And so overfitting is, it's not hard to do.
Actually, John Tukey, who the inventor of exploratory data analysis, in 1958, 10 years before he did exploratory data analysis, he was giving a seminar at Stanford, and he made the following statement: we must sit loosely and soundly in the data. And when we overfit, we sit too tight in the soundly. In fact, the data is writing us, right?
So that we just take the parameter estimation, we can drop the optimization and we take care of the parameter estimation.
Right.
Tell about that.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm going to illustrate all of these issues in a moment. By the way, just the last bullet. The other term I've seen people use is reverse engineering, which I know what they mean. Here's the real world, and I'm going to make an Intel silicon chip which matches that. But it's not the flavor.
How many times about that? Because we've been exploring how to use for formal engineering design, reverse engineering biology design, and in that context.
I was actually originally going to be putting crossouts before that between these. Then I decided, well, I understand the meaning for it. It's just that it's confusing to people who are crossing fields. These two terms get confusing, and especially the notion of parameter optimization. It's always optimal with respect to what. So these terms tend to be more specific about what you're trying to do.
I've noticed a particular instance of reverse engineering where, in many instances, people are looking at the protein structure and trying to reverse engineer and figure out what the genetic structure was that generated the protein structure. And it's not a determined thing. But they're doing a lot in genetic imaging, for example. They're doing a lot of work where they look at the phenotypes and try to infer the genotypes. That's a peculiar kind of reverse engineering that might or might not be right.
What's the difference between parameter estimation and optimization in terms of MVP?
Oh, well, it's the estimation actually signals to the world, I don't know the parameters. in fact, estimation itself, in fact, probably we'll talk about, there's interval estimation. So you shouldn't say, I know the parameters exactly. The best what you do is you can say, well, I think here's a region, here's a probability region, or a confidence region, in which I think the parameters lie. There's some certainty, there is some parameter vector out there, I can never know it. This parameter optimization seems to say, this is the parameter vector that makes the model fit the data. And it makes it seem as though the parameter is known with certainty. Again, I didn't put a cross out because if you talk to somebody, they'll explain what they mean. It's just this thing seems to put the emphasis on the fact it's only estimation. If I have enough data and enough quality data, that is, for example, the dimensionality of the data has to certainly be greater than the dimensionality of the model, then I can start focusing in and I can start discriminating fine differences. I can say, no, this parameter rate constant is 10.7. It's not 12. That kind of. Anyway, that's the nature in which I'd avoid that term. So now let me get to this issue about identifiability. Now there's a tremendous literature going back to Bellman and even earlier. A lot of it is in the compartmental modeling literature because the issues of identifiability occurred a lot in the scales I had in the beginning. At the medical scale, where you can only do very limited input-output systems. Now, I can give a drug to a patient, that's about the input I can do, and I can measure plasma concentrations. I can't tweak everything. So identifiability of the system is very important. So I've given some references, some of the older references, and then some of the more modern references. The general idea of structural, sometimes called a priori identifiability, it's a question that's being asked. So the question has some givens. What are the givens? Well, there's two main. One is that I have a specified experiment design. By the way, there's no data involved here. This is all theoretical, saying, suppose I am going to do an experiment, and I'm going to tell you what the design space is. Now, I'm going to give you the example that I'm going to use. For example, the simplest kind of design space, here are a range of times you're allowed to sample. You can take as many samples as you want in that time, but this is the range. That's called the design space. You could also have that maybe the part of the design space is I could change the pH of the system. Or I might have an indicator variable which tells me which species I could measure. So, but you've specified the nature of the design by some design variable. I'm going to break that out. So include also, for example, there can be specified inputs. Also the nature of the inputs. You might say I'm going to give a bolus input. I'm going to do continuous infusion. And I'm going to do it to species number 13, but you've specified what the design is. And the final bit of the experiment design is you've said what you're going to measure. What are the dependent variables? They may be a subset of the state variables, and they may be related to unknown parameters. For example, in the pharmacokinetic context, those volumes of distribution often are unknown. So those may be part of the estimable parameter. So that's the specified. Given that this experiment is going to be done, now the second part is given is somebody has given me a specific structural model that they think is going to represent the truth. This is one of the limitations of this. It has to be a model that I think is true. It has an unknown parameter vector theta, so the theta might contain all the KIJs, it might contain volumes of distributions, it might contain blood flows, things that are fixed but unknown. And it might be in some space. For example, most of these spaces are in positive quadrant. That is, all the rate constants usually are physical, so they can't be negative. There may be also other regions in this. And P is the dimensionality of the parameter vector. That's another thing. This is not for infinite dimension spaces. This is for finite dimension, where they have a system of differential equations, but the number of parameters themselves also is finite. Well, it could depend. The one that we saw with the insulin, the full set of P's was on the order of, I think, like 60 parameters. In compartmental model, P might be on the order of as small as 3. I've seen it. I worked with one where it was 11. And we're asking the question, how much of that parameter vector can be known? Essentially, that's what at the bottom here is. I'm going to be observing data. It's going to be some specified function of independent variables. I've only indicated here time, but of course there are other independent variables, things that you've manipulated, and this parameter vector theta, plus no error. So we're going to, in the identifiability, the pure a priori saying, there's not even any errors. The question then is there a unique choice of thetas that will reproduce the data that I'm going to observe? So for example, because there's an inverse map here, I'm going to have data, can I infer theta? So is it going to be a one-to-one map, in which case it's unique, or is it going to be one-to-many map? So there's nothing beats this thing like an illustration. So this is a cartoon. So the cartoon is that I've specified a design here. The design is I can only sample between time 0 and whatever this is, so this space S. And I'm actually allowed to do two measurements. I have a single input. I'm going to sample species, the concentration of species X1, and the sum of the concentrations of species X2 plus X3. And when I do the experiment, my realization will be a curve. So the data is going to actually be a function. I'm going to have this one and this one. And I have three answers to the identifiability question. It might be that every realization, you give me a parameter vector theta, it will produce a set of curves. So, and this curve maps back to just some simple point. Any other point here would produce curves that are completely different from those. That would be an example of global identifiability. And it's the thing we want, because if this exists, then we would think, well, at least this is the minimum. If I add data, if I can't even get a unique answer, what's going to happen when I have real data, which has a finite number of data points and is also measuring the error? You might think, well, you know, what else? Well, it turns out that there's a lot of other things that can happen. One thing that can happen is you might get a finite number, or at least a countable number, of solutions. For example, this is an example. It's called local identifiability, where three different separable parameter vectors give you exactly the same picture for the observed data. And by the way, identifiability gets complex because notice that this is all theoretical. So the question is, you can ask, is this mapping true for all theta? Sometimes it's for a set of measure 0 and whatever it is. Those niceties I'm going to ignore. In this particular case, though, at least I'm showing you, if this were the case, it would say that each of these three points are in some sense indistinguishable, because each of these three give you exactly the same observed data. Now what would happen is, local identifiability isn't always that bad. If they're widely separated, you may have prior knowledge to say, oh, it's ridiculous, theta 2 can't be this large. Theta 2 is probably somewhere around here, so one of these two is the data. So local identifiability isn't all that bad. The problem arises is sometimes they're pretty close to each other. But the worst case is the case when you have, well, an easy example is where you have more parameters than you have data. And then what can happen is there could be an uncountable collection of data. I've shown you here, there's sometimes you get a manifold of data. All of these, of parameter vectors, all of these points in parameter space map to the same data. So that's a pure example of pure unidentifiability. Very generally, this thing is lower dimension. If the dimensionality of theta is p, generally this is at least it's less than, for example, there are cases where this is just simply a curve. So that although I can't estimate any theta uniquely, there's some one-dimensional manifold. So if you told me one of the components of theta, I'd get all the rest. It may be an example of where the experiment's not good.
But
in fact, very often that's the case. Because we're assuming the model is true, but somehow you designed the experiment that you could not recover the theta uniquely. And in fact, what good identifiability analysis is one of the steps to saying, hey, okay, if I do this experiment, it's going to be wasteful because I'm not going to get the parameters uniquely. Let me play with the analytic issues of the software. How can I improve the design? How could I get to one of these two cases? For example, maybe what I have to do is separate. Maybe the problem I'm having here is that I'm measuring the sum of x2 plus x3. Maybe I'll have to do another experiment and try to separate the two. And that then suddenly would give me a unique mapping, push me over here.
So
that
can't biologically be the case that a different set of parameters, you in reality can give the same solution. have, you know, to get a particular result.
Well,
no. Can happen in different.
Yes, well, ultimately, if you did the experiment and you measured every single state variable over every single possible time, over every single possible input, if you had this case, then there's something wrong with your model. Right. It's got to be that your model is describing things uniquely. So ultimately, you want to have it so that the experiment is large enough, you should be able to get to some unique mapping. Otherwise, the model is not being able to predict anything.
It's simply separate.
That's right.
And you're just measuring the sum. That would just be a constant. And you wouldn't be able to measure anything for the rate.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. In fact, I have an even more trivial example. So, I mean, that's actually a very rich example because that happens a lot. So here's a trivial example where the design space is limited. Okay, I'm only allowed to sample at 1.7 hours. Okay, so the model is that y is going to decrease as a sum of exponentials, and my parameter vector is two-dimensional a and k, but I can only sample there. Okay, well, there's an infinite number of parameters that'll fit that data, okay? And here's that manifold in theta space, okay? Now, it's trivial, but it shows, by the way, notice, by the way, it's one-dimensional, because all I can get, since I have only one time point, is I can only get one of the parameters out. You might say, well, okay, so if I increase this, I could get some. It turns out, yes, it's true. We're going to come to the noise thing later. If I was allowed to get two or more samples, then, in principle, if the data was measured without error, I could distinguish whether it was this curve or this curve. But I mean, if I had one sample here and one sample here, once you add noise to it, the identifiability problem explodes. You know, it becomes, that is what we'll talk at the end, is the numerical identifiability. That is, you know, what precision can you come up with? So again, I'm reminding you, we're pretending as though the data is measured without error. Here, it is absolutely physically impossible to separate A and K, but at least these are the feasible regions. This does also, the other advantage for this cartoon is it shows K is bounded below. That cap theta space is that all the parameters are non-negative. So we know that if K is not zero, that means actually with this data, I am at least going to get a lower bound for A. So even though this is an unidentifiable experiment, if A, for example, is going to be a function of the volume of distribution or the dose that's given, at least this can be useful in getting some interval estimate of something I want. And in fact, if I had an upper bound for K, I'd get also an upper bound for A. So unidentifiable models don't necessarily give you nothing. They may give you, especially for the nonlinear models, by the way, here's another term. These models, this model is linear as a systems model, but it's nonlinear as an estimation problem. And the models that are nonlinear in the parameters, which these are, very often will give you peculiar identifiability regions and sometimes allow you to get upper and lower bounds on unidentifiable parameters. I won't grind through the example. I'll show you an example, but I'll make it sense. It'll be a compartmental. Usually continue.
Yeah, we really don't like that. I mean, so much more than the second case when you have a bunch of finite numbers.
Well, usually when it's finite, it's two. In fact, that's going to be here. This is an example of this is a classical local identifiability problem. There's only two unique solutions. And often they're separated enough that I know where they are. But when there's a continuum of solutions, and you know, you don't know where things are, unless that continuum is bounded in space and really fine. And there are some cases like that where the Joe DiStefano here at UCLA has called it quasi-identifiability, which you get a continuum, this mass of thetas that are consistent in the data, but it's bounded. And the bounded region is a small fraction of the absolute values of the parameters. So that's actually not a bad situation. It says that I'm going to be doing an experiment, I'll never be able to recover the parameters uniquely, but at least I can get some upper and lower bounds. Right. But at least what you can do is you can put probability statements, for example. Right, but you might be able to say, well, at least you can say, you know, here's a 95% credibility region, and if it's useful, that's important. Also, what do you want to use these regions for? You may want, let's say, for example, you're looking at an intact individual, and you want to use the parameters for designing a cancer treatment. If the it may be that the system is robust enough, I didn't know to, need to know the parameters with 5% coefficient of variations. Maybe what the information I have is there. So ultimately, we do want to get some notions about precision of parameter estimates. Again, right now, though, is we're pretending what would happen if I had absolutely no data errors. And later on, what I'll do is I'll put fuzz balls around the points. When there are data errors, these points now start getting uncertainty. Okay. Anyway, this is a cute example to show you an example of a system that looks like it should be identifiable. It only has three parameters. The model, this is a compartmental model. The experiment is that you're sampling the concentration here. So here it turns out it's a bolus input of a known dose. I'm going to be allowed, my sample space S is going to be all time, all positive time, so I can collect a million data points here. Curve is going to look like that. So for each data point, it turns out that there's actually two vectors that will give you the exact same data. If, for example, theta is equal to k1, k2, v, if I just simply put this k1 here and put this k2 here and change v to be this value, I'll get exactly the same fit. So if k1 is not equal to k2, two separable solutions give you exactly the same curve. Now, where this arises, for example, in intact individuals, this may be drug that's taken by the gut. You've swallowed a drug. It's being absorbed into the bloodstream and then eventually it's excreted. So the volume of distribution is related to, for example, this volume of that central pool. Very often, the difference between these two will result in, for example, I'll give you examples, the ratio of K2 and K1 might be several orders of magnitude apart. So what you get is one of these volumes of distribution is several orders of magnitude apart from the other one. And prior knowledge, even without being Bayesian, you'd say, ah, that's ridiculous. It can't be this point. So this is actually turns out to be a useful model in clinical pharmacokinetics, clinical pharmacology, even though it has local identifiability, because usually one of these points is ruled out on a prior equivalence. So finally, here's an example of an unidentifiable model, and we'll look at it on dimensionality grounds. This is what's called a mammillary model. It has a central pool, and then n-1 peripheral pools that connect with, and again, say these are linear ordinary differential equations. These arrows are leaks to that environment, that pool is zero. So there are three n-1 parameters. There's three n-2 KIJs, and there's a volume of distribution. So three n-1 parameters. Now, you know that analytically, the solution to this is going to be a sum of n exponentials. This system has real eigenvalues. Well, the eigenvalues all have negative, they're not complex. All the eigenvalues are non-positive. If these peripheral pools, those diagonal elements are all distinct, then the eigenvalues are all distinct, and the solution will look like this, numerically. It'll look like a sum of exponentials. So these AIs and lambda I's, there's 2n of them, are a summary of the data. Some people call these the macro parameters. If you give me the data, you do an experiment, you put a bolus dose in pool one, and you sample pool one. I'm assuming, by the way, that we're not sampling all the other pools. You just sample pool one. Then the most amount of dimensionality you can get out of pool one is 2n. And you'll be able to identify these two parameters, 2n parameters uniquely, as long as you put some sort of ordering. So the common ordering, for example, is that you order the lambda i's. So the KIJs and the volume of distribution, that's 3n-1. You can't map 2n dimensional space 1-to-1 to the 3n-1 space. So just on dimensionality arguments alone, the full set of KIJs and the volume of distribution is unidentifiable. It turns out, by the way, that it's actually pretty trivial. The volume of distribution alone is identifiable. The reason is maybe easily clear. If I put a dose in here and I sample the concentration here immediately, I recover what the volume distribution is. So in principle, I can get the volume distribution, but I may not be, there'll be an uncountable set of KIJs in this fully parameterized model that will match the data. Now, if I put constraints on the system, then I may know it. For example, if I set all of these leaks to zero except one of them, then the system becomes identifiable. And there's a lot, and or if I sample multiple pools, not just sample pool one, but I sample the peripheral pools. And these things have been worked out. Some of the references refer to this. There is one thing that can be done, is these are the parameters of interest. You're interested in the whole set of KIJs and volume distribution. That turns out to be a set of identifiable parameters, also of the same dimensionality as the AIs and lambdas. And what it is, if, for example, is you can identify the diagonal entries of that K matrix. And you can also estimate these cross products, K1, so the product of this times this, the product of that times that. And given that, and you can work through the math, it turns out that the complete set of KIJs then therefore is interval identifiable. Yep. Certainly, you have once you have the diagonal elements, you have upper and lower, immediately you have upper and lower bounds for all the KIJs. And actually, because you have these cross products, you can actually find them. And Joe DiStefano has, and others in the lab, somewhere back here, and I, we have some elementary papers which give these interval identifiability estimates for this mammillary model. There's another one called the catenary model. It's just simply a chain, a concatenation of pools. So that given a particular input-output experiment, you can recover, it may not be identifiable, but at least you can identify a lower order set of parameter combinations which are identifiable. And then from there, you can either say, well, that's interesting, I know these combinations, or get some interval identification. And then when you add noise on it, you get noise on the intervals, on the edges. So the question is there a systematic approach to identifiability? And the answer is yes, but they're very difficult. The first one is the dimensionality argument. That's easy. You know, if I have 1,800 parameters and I have a data set which is a dimension 3, okay, that's going to be unidentifiable. So a lot of good work has been put out for linear systems, especially for departmental models, and I have some of those in the references. The idea is as follows. We're trying to get that mapping from the data to the parameter vector. Well, data is, that's in function space. But since our models are parameterized by a finite dimensional parameter vector, what I could try to do is, why don't I convert that problem to solvability of a finite system of algebraic equations? That we can solve. In fact, there's an expert here who's told me, this whole idea about working and solving, for example, systems of polynomial equations and using Grubner bases and the Buchberger algorithm to find, to count how many solutions there are and actually find the solutions. This is a moderately well-defined problem. Still a lot of open questions. So how can one do that? Well, for linear systems, one of the methods is Laplace transforms. You can get an input-output system for these compartmental systems. The Laplace transforms are rational polynomials, where the numerator and the denominators are functions of the KIJs, the unknown parameter constants. And to say that I have observed the data means that I've actually observed all the elements in the Laplace transform numerically. And therefore, numerically, these things are rational polynomials. So that's one of the early methods for doing algebraic identifiability, was looking directly at the Laplace domain. More general method is to say, if I've observed the data, now there's a lot of assumptions, the data has to be sufficiently smooth, then if I look at the Taylor series expansion, for example, around zero, then I will know the data. And we have a differential equation. We have an equation written out as y dot equals some function of the state variables. Therefore, I can even know y double dot. Take the derivative through that, and I get, and evaluate all of that at zero. For a linear system, you only need a finite number of those because of the properties of linear input-output systems. Turns out for nonlinear systems, you might need an infinite number of those. But each one of these, y valued at 0, y dot at 0, y double dot at 0, gives you a system of algebraic, usually polynomials or rational polynomials, in the KIJs, who have a numerical value, specifically these numerical values. And you can then use Grobner bases, things of that nature, to try to determine whether I can get a unique mapping of the data, which now is represented as these numbers, to the KIJs or whatever the combination is. Moreover, some of the more recent papers, especially some of the papers by Sakamani, is an attempt to find out if the system is unidentifiable, can I peel out the identifiable parameter combinations? Now there's an infinite, you know, once you have an identifiable parameter combination, if I square them, those are also identifiable. So there's many, many different ways of getting identifiable parameter combinations. Some of the methods that are being proposed are not necessarily the smallest set, but there's still some really interesting questions. And these are the approaches. So again, I would suggest you look at some of the papers by Rodali and Sakamani, and then there's some older references, and then they go back to the original references in the 50s and 60s. Dimensionality of the what?
Is Sakamani follow the possibilities which are all in the same data?
Yes, that's actually turns out to be these similarity transformation approaches. Right, but unfortunately you don't necessarily get them exactly perpendicular. Right, and they may be ugly because the things that you really want to have often are, if they're identifiable parameter combinations, which are sums of products of all the parameters, they're not that useful. You like to have parameter combinations where they're subsets of things. So some of the, and these are very intensive, they all use computer algebra. They use either Maple or Mathematica. Some of them are coupled to the old thing, Reduce. There's still some on the market that use that. And they try to get out efficient parameter combinations that are interpretable. But they're not all foolproof, especially for the nonlinear systems. These problems are, in some cases, they can't be solved. They may be identifiable, but when you try to solve all these conditions, you can go on forever and ever. So there's some ad hoc methods people are using. For example, what they're doing is, well, it's a method that I'm going to talk about in a second, which is a numerical approach. The numerical approach is pick a value of theta. Okay, don't just do it in theory. Pick a value of theta star, and generate some real data and play with that. That sometimes can tease things out. Now, this specific thing is, the idea, so you actually pick a value of theta, all the values of theta, pick something which you think is biologically reasonable, and now generate a observed data vector y. Well, except I'm not going to repeat this over and over again. Okay, I may only do this once or twice, just to see if the system is locally identifiable around the region of this particular value of theta. Okay, because otherwise you'd have to test the entire theta space. Okay. So this is a right, but then you wind up always in Monte Carlo. You always mostly wind up looking at the edges, the thin shell of parameter space. Right. Okay. each of these steps, by the way, is very time consuming. So. This is used at least to give you some operating idea. If, for example, it's not identifiable when you do this, then you can stop at that point. You can say, I know I found a value of theta for which it's identifiable. The probability of my landing that it being locally identifiable is zero, because that's a set of measures zero. There's a manifold out there which is of a full dimensionality that I fall on. So very often this thing is useful. It'll tell you if the system is identifiable or not, at least for a reasonable range, a regional parameter vector. So anyway, the idea is numerically what you do is you set up now, looks like there's a least squares problem. You pick some weighting matrix. And by the way, when you're doing this for statistical purposes, this weighting matrix should be proportional to the inverse of a covariance matrix of the measurement errors. The idea, though, is that I set this up. Now, this is a function of theta, and it's going to be equal to zero when theta is equal to the true value of theta that I generated the data from. So the identifiability question is, does this Q function, which is going to be, it's going to be roughly parabolic around the true value of theta, your theta star is the one I picked to do the simulation. And Q of theta is going to be sort of roughly parabolic, hopefully, around theta star, meaning that in any neighborhood, as once I deviate from theta star, Q of theta should be non-zero. Well, if there's a set of thetas for which Q of theta is zero, so if it's Q of theta is zero for not only theta equal to theta star, but for a whole set of others, then the system is unidentifiable. And so if I could get the Jacobian of that or get some measure, there's an, you know, there's an implicit function theorem here. So one Q trick.
Sorry, I got confused. So you sound like you're assuming that around theta,
sorry, No. There's no data errors. I generate perfect data. When I said it's parabolic, I said, because I'm doing a Taylor's expansion around, the Q of theta is, you know, it, F is a function of theta. If I did a Taylor's expansion, let's say, for example, F was linear around theta, then this would be Y minus a function of theta. So this would be a quadratic form in theta. So Q of theta would be parabolic of theta. That's the only reason why I said it would look. That Q of theta, we know that it can't, Q of theta can't be, this is a quadratic form. So Q of theta can only be zero when this vector, and W has full rank. So Q of theta can only be zero when Y is equal to F for all I. Okay. And the question the nature of this thing is it might actually be equal to zero for not only theta equal to theta star, the one that generated the simulation data, but for many other values of theta. If that's the case, there might be a manifold of thetas. So one way of knowing that, it turns out, is to do some convert this to a statistical problem and get what is called an information matrix. And if the rank of this matrix is full, then I know that the system is at least locally identifiable. Whereas if the rank of this matrix, if this is rank deficient, then I know locally there's some combination of parameters which I can start at a parameter vector theta star, and there's a direction in which I can follow where Q of theta will still remain zero. That is, I'll be tracing that manifold.
Can this happen in government?
Yes. No. But don't forget, that means that Y sub I minus F, and I'm doing it over all I. Each of these terms is a, this is a sum of squares. Imagine, for example, that I is just one, so I'm only observing one vector, one component. Then this is just a square. Right here. I point this out because a lot of the packages, a lot of the statistical packages give you this stuff. They'll give you a covariance matrix, which is an asymptotic one, which is the inverse of this thing. And if they tell you, I can't invert the information matrix, they're telling you that M is not a full rank. So this is a way of tricking your favorite data fitting program to solving the identifiability problem. I only have a few more slides, and I guess it's getting late, so let me just go through them. One of the things is, if you notice, let me just show you here, notice that this information matrix is built up from things here, and notice what this is. This is the partial of Y with respect to the parameters. These are the sensitivities that you were talking about an hour ago. How does Y change if I actually jiggle the parameters? So it's reasonable that this approach will actually give you some information. And in fact, all of these approaches to parameter estimation precision, or this numerical trick, which is, you know, again, looking at the property with this Q function, they all depend upon knowing something about the sensitivities. And unfortunately, that's difficult, because the dimensionality of the system is large. If the number of parameters is 100, and the number of components of the vector is 100, then you have the dy d theta is 100 by 100 matrix. So that can be huge. So it's useful. The sensitivity vector is useful. It gives you that numerical thing I had before. It's useful if you're doing curve fitting and you're doing numerical searches on the theta space to, you know, minimize these squares. It gets you asymptotic estimates and covariance matrices, but they're difficult. So there are things in the literature, sort of a dumb way, but it works, is to do one-sided or two-sided differences at the end. Okay, just got right them through. There are sometimes secant approximations. There's a statistical package. It's an old one. It's still out on the market, the MDPAR, which doesn't do all the derivatives exactly. It says as long as it's searching the space, it takes secant approximations for these things. And then the classic method, and I've given some literature on that in the bibliography, is to augment the state differential equations with sensitivity differential equations. After all, we have y dot equals something. Well, then I could take partial of y dot with respect to the parameters. And so these sensitivity vectors then get tacked on. So if you have a very efficient high dimensional, I mean, you can increase the state space of different equations a lot, but people use that. So options, the model is unidentifiable. Once you know that the model is unidentifiable, these concepts allow you to start thinking about improving the design. Augment the outputs, get better experimental probes, or evaluate identifiable parameter combinations. This is W3 NAMCAT. This is the things I mentioned about the mammillary and catenary models, if anyone is interested. And then you can convert it into a statistical problem. You can take your external information and put it as Bayesian priors, and you can compute the statistical. The reason why I want to show you that there's a statistical issue is that this, although the mapping might be unique if the data is perfect, the data is imperfect and I have finites, then we have uncertainty. So the mapping is not, maybe this might be the best estimate, but there are precision issues. So this is the last slide, just some general comments. Even if the model is identifiable, so for example, if you think that there's additive error or multiplicative error, you have to be concerned about the numerical identifiability. With reasonably, even with reasonable small noise, these uncertainty intervals can be enormous. In which case, for practical purposes, it's unidentifiable. So just simply knowing it's identifiable with perfect data doesn't mean it's great with real data. And so there, jump to the bottom, there's issues in optimal experiment design where you try to say, well, let's try to make those uncertainty intervals as small as possible. If you think of them in terms of, for example, entropy, Shannon entropy, what I'd like to do is I'd like to sort of know, you know, maybe get the volume of some confidence region as small as possible. And so it turns out a cute trick is if you take the determinant of the covariance matrix, which is inverse the determinant of that information matrix. So if you minimize this, it's the same as maximizing the determinant of the information matrix. You maximize the change in the entropy about your information about where the theta vector is. And for example, there are judicious choice of times. That might be much better. You might have sampled the system much too early in the beginning and very little sampling of the long time. So you have no long time information. So well-chosen design points can improve these things. So the end result is that our system models are complex. Some of the issues from identifiability methods may be improving our ability to